Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel and entertainment journalist. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about the seven chapters in their life's travel diaries. From their earliest childhood travel memory and the first place they fell in love with, to their hidden gem and what's at the top of their travel bucket list. We'll be uncovering their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. How are you all doing this week? I hope that you're well. I hope you enjoyed Steve Backshall as much as I loved speaking to him. Such a great storyteller. Oh, and this week I had a really unforgettable travel experience that I couldn't recommend more for a special treat. A lot of you probably already seen this on my Instagram. I've had so many messages from you about it. I was invited for the day on the Belmond British Pullman. So the Belmond British Pullman is such a historic train, the same company that owned the Orient Express. And they were launching a new train carriage, which was designed by Wes Anderson, the iconic film director. So, you know, Wes is known for his distinctive aesthetic, and you can see that throughout this carriage. Oh, it's stunning. Very symmetrical, of course, with pastel pink ceilings and then this rich green detailing on the carpets and chairs and amazing wooden marquetry all the way around. It really feels like you're stepping onto one of his film sets. So the journey starts at Victoria Station in London, and it's a round trip, but we went on a tour of the Kent coast, and it reminded me of Tom Kerridge's episode back in season 2 where he chose the North Kent coast as his hidden gem, because all these stops that we were going past were places that he mentioned. So it reminded me I need to go back there and try all those amazing seafood restaurants that he told us about. If you haven't listened to that episode, that was one of my favorites back at the beginning of the podcast. There's a real sense of occasion about the whole thing. You're served a 5-course meal, so decadent, and it was just lovely to kind of come together for a bit of a celebratory feel. So a big thank you to Belmond for inviting me, and goodness, that would be the perfect Christmas present for the right someone. Okay, on to today's guest. She is a number one best-selling author, one of the UK's most successful fiction authors. She's the host of Happy Mum, Happy Baby, the chart-topping podcast, which sees her interview celeb guests about the highs and lows of parenting. She and her husband, Tom Fletcher, from the band McFly, have a huge YouTube presence where they perform together. And she's I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here's reigning champion, the queen of the castle. It is the multi-talented Giovanna Fletcher. So G has been traveling since a very young age, as her dad is Italian. So she tells us about her annual trips to visit her family in Italy and what that meant to her. She and Tom are kind of obsessed with Disney, and she brings to life the magic and joy of holidays at the Disney parks. And much of her new book is also inspired by travel, by the country of Peru. So we talk about that. We also cover her love of trekking, her advice about traveling with 3 young kids, and what it was like to interview Kate Middleton for her podcast and the whirlwind of press that came after. All that and so much more coming up on the Travel Diaries. Giovanna Fletcher, welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's been an interesting one because obviously I've listened to the podcast. I know some of the questions that will be asked. So in prep, I've kind of been going, oh, yes, I love that place. And then, oh, no, but what about this place? And I'm literally just before coming on going, what about the whole of Australia? Like, oh, gosh.
It's getting too excited. It's almost as hard as it's like picking between your children.
But pretty much.
Now, it looks like you are speaking to me at like an epic kind of Christmas grotto. Where are you?
I'm in my new office. So we've just moved. And it's been quite a big job. We have an outdoor space now for our office, which is lovely because for the last 7 years, we've been trying to write in everything in the house with the kids there, which is amazing because, you know, you're at home working. But, you know, when you're in the middle of writing an important scene or a chapter, and then someone comes in to ask you for a snack or, you know, for something really simple, you're kind of like, oh yeah, get torn away a bit. So now I have my own sort of creative space that's essentially a barn.
That's beautiful. I can't believe that you just told me that you've moved house, because I was literally about to open the podcast by saying how busy you must be. You've got a new novel out. Your husband Tom is on Strictly Come Dancing.
Yeah.
3 kids under 6.
is it?
Seven.
Three kids under seven. Yeah. I mean, how are you holding up?
I'm so tired right now. Plus, last night we decided to take them to see Back to the Future, the musical.
Oh, wow.
So it was a late night, you know, by the time you get home and everyone's back in bed. So I am quite frazzled. Interestingly, though, Tom said the other day, we sat down having breakfast and he was like, you know, this house move has been really seamless. I'm like, because you weren't here. You didn't see any of it happen. But it is interesting because we were in one house for 16 years and suddenly moving. I think the idea of it felt quite daunting when it and emotional. It was really emotional because we'd done everything there, you know. We'd grown up, we'd had got married there, had kids, but actually this is our home now. It's amazing how your mind quickly shifts, adapts, I guess.
Did you move to a new area?
It's about 20 minutes away from where we were, but closer for the school run. The school run was the thing that was that meant really that things had to change a little bit, just because we spent so much of our time in the car.
Yeah.
And the kids get so restless. They don't get tired at all. They get restless.
They never get tired.
Literally, these boys, when they wake up in the morning, they are literally, you hear the first breath, and then that's it. It's like they fill up their lungs for the day and then they are off. Yeah. So if the first fight hasn't happened by 6:30 in the morning, I mean, you know, that's not a day.
Really? Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. All this to come one day.
Honestly, they can't walk past each other without a fist flying out, a foot for no reason. And you're just like, okay. Let me just go hang out in my office.
We're going to mentally transport ourselves to somewhere.
Please do.
Far away. Maybe times, yes. Pre-kids, who knows? A journey through the 7 chapters of your life's travel diaries. And we're going to go all the way back to your childhood for chapter 1, which is your earliest childhood travel memory.
So when I was younger, so my dad's Italian, fully Italian. He moved over here when he was 19. And as a result of that, most summers we would go. Well, we went every summer, but for the majority of the summer, we would go over to Italy to a little place called Valva, which is near Naples. It's actually in Campania. And it is just the most magical place. So there was actually a huge earthquake over there about 40 years ago. And it meant that for the first 15 years of us going over there, they were actually living in this temporary accommodation that had been up for quite some time. It was up for about 20 years. That they were living in this temporary accommodation, which was like big concrete slabs on the bottom and then wooden sort of chalets on the top. Limited water supply, like you'd get water for an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening, often cold. You'd have to walk up the mountains for your water, your drinking water. But it was just the most magical place in so many ways because it was stripped back of all the stuff that you would have at home. It was all about play. It was all about being outside. It was all about creativity and imagination. And and we used to drive there and we used to never tell Nonna when we were going to be arriving. So you had that big drive where, you know, we would be sat in the back of the car. I'd have a cool box on the bottom of my legs. So I'd have to sit cross-legged the whole drive to Italy. I think we flew once, but we had bad ears. Plus, because we were there for quite some time, it made sense to drive.
Well,
plus,
we
used to bring back a lot of wine.
Oh, well, yes.
Not for us kids, but, you know, actually, to be honest, we did used to have a little bit of wine. But that's such an Italian thing.
Yeah.
So we used to sit in the back of the car. Me and Georgia used to play, me and my sister used to play sort of head tennis with Mario's head for most of the journey because we didn't want him leaning on us. and then we used to drive. And it wasn't like the roads were really quite windy. It's not like the big motorway systems that there are now. But it was always, yeah. It's so funny, those little things that you suddenly remember, like getting to Calais and, you know, all the lights and the things that you were about to get on the boat all the way back and stuff. All those little things and those sounds and those noises getting on the boat. And it was, even the drive there was quite exciting. And I seem to remember us only ever having 3 tapes in the car, and they were Billy Ocean, Tina Turner, all three best of Billy Ocean, Tina Turner and Bananarama. And we used to sing them as much as possible until Dad eventually pulled out the traditional Italian music and we would have to listen to that while going around the mountains.
So what was it like? So you say it's mountainous, like when you, what did it look like? What did it feel like when you finally made it there?
Well, it was all quite rough and ready, I guess, compared to the world that we were living in back home. Although, you know, we lived in Barkingside. It was quite a sort of a built up area. you know, cars everywhere. And I don't know, Italy is a very different vibe, like especially there. It's all about food and socializing and drinking and community and family. View-wise, you'd literally, there's mountain, there's houses that are literally, they don't look like they should be sitting where they are.
They're just perched.
They're just perched, yeah. And you go, and as you're driving through, it's like there's these mountains where there's nothing other than at the top of the mountain, obviously because of the snow and everything like that, that comes. But yeah, just these different villages that sit on top of these mountains that are all so spread apart. And I find it really fascinating as well, the dialect, even within those places, because they have such a strong dialect. Whereas if you were to go to the next village, especially years ago, you know, there'd be a definite language barrier almost of how people speak. Yeah, and all the little ways that people might even just say, how are you, and things like that. You know, it's it would mean nonsense to another village. Wow. And so when we used to arrive when we were younger, all these sort of temporary houses were in rows up a mountain, and there'd be these big concrete like slab type steps going between them that you'd have to go up to get the water when you're going up the mountains. And that's the thing, I guess, for us kids, we were allowed to do things like go up to the mountains and get water. Mm. You know, so we'd take our, oh God, the water, what was the water carrier thing called? I don't know, our little container. And we go up there, and it's just simple things like going past the farms and the dogs barking and the chickens and seeing the geckos and the lizards and whatever else there is. It felt very different to life back home. And there was this huge football pitch. This was one of the fun parts about our time. There was this huge football pitch that I think it was built for Italian 1990 games, mm-hmm. football games. And was that the Euros? Possibly the Euros. But it was, you know, it was all quite broken down and quite unused. But we used to just go round and round that and just sing and make up songs and things like that. So yeah, it is that thing. If you had that freedom of people knowing where you were, especially in a little village like that, like everyone knew that there were people around. They knew who we were related to. And there's this great thing about being there as well, where because everyone was so close house-wise in proximity, they would just shout at each other. They'd shout at the houses, you know, so there's just this constant noise. And you'd think that people were like angry at each other for anything, and that dad would be like, no, they're just saying, do you want some potatoes? Like, oh, okay, it's all good.
But I know what you mean about, like, when you were saying about you didn't tell your nonna that you were going to arrive, and that kind of excitement. Like, my grandma also lived in another country, and in the US, and going over there at a part of the school holidays, that, you know, that was such an important part of my identity, and still is. Like, that was where I went, and that was where we had the special bond. And also, your mum is Argentinian, is that right?
No, that's not true.
Is that on Wikipedia? I think that's a Wikipedia.
It's on Wikipedia. Yeah, no, my mum is born and bred in Essex.
I was like, so tell me about Argentina.
Sorry, no, she's not. I don't even know. I think that's probably an Argentinian McFly fan who has just claimed my mum.
So
but no, my mum, she doesn't look Argentinian in the slightest. She's blonde with blue eyes. But no, she grew up in Essex. So yeah, and even for her, like, traveling away anywhere, that didn't happen at all. So I think having a husband that was from a different place was quite a strange thing for her as well.
And was your Italianness like an important part of you?
Absolutely. It felt something I've always been really, really proud of. And when you go over there, and a large part of it is when you go over there and you see how the community works together, and how, you know, all the older people within the community, they get looked after. You know, they've got a constant stream of visitors, whether that's nephews or cousins. You know, they're constantly, people are coming over to drop off food that they've grown, or, you know, just checking in. And you know, you go somewhere and there's always stuff offered, whether it's just a very nurturing environment. You know, it's people like to see people. They like to make people happy. They like to make people feel welcome. And even us, you know, I don't speak Italian properly. You know, I speak a little bit, but I wouldn't be able to hold a good conversation. But, you know, everyone still included us. And we spend most of our time going, what do they say, Dad? What do they say, Dad? But, you know, so it's that typical thing where everyone just speaks a lot louder at you, saying the same thing.
And you speak back with an Italian accent in English. That's what I always do. So chapter two is the first place that you fell in love with.
It's got to be Paris.
The city of love.
Yeah. Well, I'd been there before on an art trip at school when I was in sixth form, and I absolutely loved it. Loved every single thing about it. But then there was a summer where Tom and the McFly guys randomly had 10 days off, which back then was just, it just didn't happen. So me and Tom decided to go to Paris, and all the other boys were with their partners. They decided to go to the Caribbean, and me and Tom were like, no, we're going to go to Paris and we're going to have this fun time. And, you know, we'll go to Disneyland Paris as well. It'd be amazing. And I can remember getting there and being a bit like, oh, we made the wrong decision, but it was the best thing ever. Just the fact that you can walk everywhere, soak everything up. And we did go in August as well, so, you know, and it is a lot like Italy in the sense that people just that are from there just leave, like certain shops are shut, certain things just aren't available. But there was just this ease about it, you know. As you might have already gathered, I'm all about food and wine. So, you know, we're just enjoying those meals and just milling around, taking in the art and the spontaneity of it. And I think that was probably my first holiday that I'd been on where there were things to do. I think before that, my idea of a holiday would be sun lounger, beach,
fly and flop.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just switch me off right now. But it was so much fun going around and soaking up as much of the city as possible. And also just having no schedule and just kind of going, well, where do we want to go? What do we want to see? And trying things out. Like, we even spent one day, I think we'd just been reading, oh, it could be the Da Vinci Code or Angels and Demons. I can't remember, one of Dan Brown's books that has about the Meridian Line and about how Paris tried to get it at some point with these rows. I think they're like brass rows things that are in a line across the city. So we spent a day just going around and seeing how many of them we could find.
That's so fun though, isn't it? Like, getting really like immersed in a city, like getting really under your skin, like just also not feeling like you have to tick off tons of stuff. You were just focusing on one element of it, which is really nice.
Although we were out on, well, in London, they'd be called Boris bikes, but the bikes that you just kind of hire and take out. And I realised I probably hadn't been on a bike for about 10 years before that. And I don't care what they say. It's not like riding a bike. I am not very good at riding those bikes. Literally going through the Parisian traffic, feeling so wobbly on this bike. Just that seeing where sort of life takes you. And I guess, can we be that spontaneous now without kids? Because I feel like, you know how sometimes you can over-romanticize things in your head when you're looking back at them?
Totally.
But I can remember even in the moment, like that was such a special holiday for us. And then, because we're big Disney fans, we went to Disneyland Paris.
And how old were you guys then, would you say?
Oh, we would have been about 21, I want to say.
Like, such a good age. Because for the listeners who might not know, you and Tom have been together since you were at school.
Yes.
So how long has it been? 13.
Well, so we met when we were 13 and we went out for a couple of days. Then he dumped me for his ex-girlfriend. I'm not bitter. It's okay. I'm over it.
It's still the first line of the story.
Yeah. I mean, it was 24 years ago, but I'm over it. And then we went out. We've basically been together since we were 18. So I'm now 36. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah. So you're in your early 20s in Disneyland, and that, I mean, what fun. I mean, I've been trying to get my husband to come with me to Disneyland or Disney World because, I mean, it is fun to just go, whatever age you are.
Exactly. It's so much fun. And my parents, we always said that we would go because we went to Italy every summer, obviously, because we had family over there. But you'd see adverts for like Disney World, whether that's Paris or Florida or even LA on telly, and you kind of be like, oh, can we go? And, you know, that's what the plan was, always to go at a certain time. And then mum and dad, unfortunately, separated. So we didn't go. But going there as an adult, you know, I can remember actually going to Florida when I was, I went to Florida when I was 21. So Paris must have been about 23, but with the Fletchers, so with Tom's family. And it just being the most magical place. Like, age is not a thing when you hit Disney. Again, it's about soaking up that environment and that magic and that creativity and the imagination. Every single thing around you is so well thought through. Even the point, like, to the point of bins. Bins, like, aren't just bins. They are a thing that might do something, or, you know, every element is magical. So
another world, isn't it? Just another
it
world.
It is completely. Yeah, and I think unless you've been there, it's because it's not a theme park. It's not like anything that we have over here at all. So, yeah, it is the most magical thing. So to go to Paris, you know, as part of our Paris trip, to go to Disneyland Paris, it felt like having a little piece of what we love over in Florida, but a lot closer. And we have since actually taken the kids to Disneyland Paris. And I've got to say, they absolutely loved it.
So, just for
a little piece of it, but without the flights, being a little bit closer to home. Disney do stuff that just simply other people just can't, in my opinion.
Favorite ride?
Oh, I do love Rock and Roller Coaster, simply because there's something when you're on it. For me, and I don't know, I really felt it last time we were there. I think I'd had the three kids. You know, you're still juggling with nap times and feed times and all of that stuff. I think I was still breastfeeding the last time we actually went. And I got on this ride, this Aerosmith ride. And, you know, Dude Looks Like Lady is playing, like pumping around you and just going on these loops and everything. I just felt ridiculously free. And I know that sounds absolutely ridiculous, but just this, just kind of like just enjoying it for that minute or however long it is, just feeling like you are completely in this and just screaming your head off and laughing whilst Steven Tyler sings in your ear. It's amazing. So-
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb super host. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Fun.
So when did you fall in love with writing? Because it was really shortly after you finished school that you were snapped up with a book deal.
Well, it probably looks like that now, but so I started writing. The first thing I ever wrote was a silly book that was just for us called Dating McFly is for Dummies. And Dating McFly for Dummies, but I'd put the is in it. And so my husband is in a band called McFly. And it was kind of, it kind of looked at all the different rules, I guess, and regulations around being a girlfriend, and all the things that you should comply to, or the things that you can do wrong. And it was just a very silly little thing, simple things.
So tell me some of the rules, yeah.
Well, when you get on a tour bus after a show, don't go and get your favourite sandwich. Don't go and get the sandwich first. Let them get it, because they've just been on stage, and you know they are going to be knackered. They need fuel. We don't. We've probably been snacking for the last 2 hours, so just let them do things like that first. To be honest, I've got to dig it out because I've got to have it somewhere here. But that was my first sort of thing of actually getting pen down to paper, or starting typing out on the keys. And I only use 3 or 4 fingers, it turns out, to type, but it's working. I'm 12 books in, it's fine. So before that I'd been at drama school and acting, and it all just got quiet. And so I was doing things like that to kind of fuel my creativity and to just keep my brain alive. And then a magazine got in touch, and they were kind of like, we know you're writing. Would you like to come and get some work experience here? So I started doing that, started doing their book reviews. Then I met an agent, and she just said to me, have you ever thought about writing fiction? Because at that point I had a blog. And I was like, well, it's a nice idea, but I love reading books, but I just don't know if I'd be good at writing them. And she was like, well, let me know if you need any advice or anything, if it's something you think about. And I just met an author one day who was just, and I didn't say anything about the idea of even writing to her, but she just said how when she tells anyone that she's an author, people say, oh, I'd love to write. Oh, if I could do anything, I'd love to write a book. I've got a really good idea, I'd love to write. And she just said, she always says to them, well, just do it. Because it's definitely one of those things, unless you sit down and actually get those words out, get those ideas down, then nothing can happen. And not only that, you don't even know if you like it. Mm. It might be one of those experiences that actually in the idea of doing it is all romantic in your head, and you're going to be sat there with your hot drink and, you know, I don't know, up in the mountains in a chalet, kind of just typing away. But the reality of it might be quite different. Mm. So I just thought, you know what, I'm going to just try it. So I came out with these 3 different summaries, picked one, started writing. And when I got to about 16,000 words, I sent it to this agent. And she was like, I think we should, let's do this. Let's absolutely do this. So it was about a year later, after many rejection letters, I've got to say as well, that Penguin decided to give me a 2-book deal. And I would say the first book was an absolute joy to write, because you're doing so without any expectation on yourself or from other people. You just trust in the process a bit more, I think. Well, no, I think now I still do, but I think that first book is like any pregnancy, really, before anything goes wrong. It's there's a nice naivety about it. You just go into it and you want to tell a story before there's any sort of complications or technical aspects involved. And then second book, you're kind of like, oh my gosh, you know, how the first book was a fluke. What is this? They're going to ask me their money back, and I've already turned it into bookshelves. Like, what am I going to do?
And did you speak to Tom about that? Because it's almost like a second album, isn't it? Like, you know, the pressure of having a great debut album.
Absolutely is. It's exactly the same thing. And thankfully, by that point, on Twitter, there was a great team of authors who were just there. And for me as well, coming from an acting background, where it's literally a case of either you've got the part or I've got the part or they've got the part. I don't know, it felt more like a dog eat dog world. Whereas with book world, people were like, well, if you write a book that gets people reading, then they might read my books. You know, so it's a bit more nurturing, I guess, in that way, and the friendships there. So I was talking to a lot of authors on Twitter and stuff, and it was amazing. Interestingly, so Tom obviously now writes. So he approaches things in a very different way. And we try not to work too much in the same time, same place, at the same time, because he can just type a lot quicker than I can, and he gets his words in a lot quicker, and I'm just sat there, you know, pondering over a sentence, wondering what word to use. And also, Tom tries to kill off all of my characters. All the time.
He does. Is this what we're whenever he's reading drafts or?
Well, yeah. So when I talk through ideas, he's like, and then she can die. And so-and-so's got to do, and I'm like, no, stop trying to kill them off every time.
What do you think that's about?
I don't know. I think maybe because he writes children's books.
Very dramatic.
And there's less death. I don't know. Just put it all in mind.
We'll come back to your newest book in a moment, but let's first pause there and discover chapter 3, which is Lovely. The place where you learn the most about yourself.
Well, interestingly, I would say Peru, which is actually where the next book is set for part of it. So it was about 12 years ago that my sister was traveling around South America, and my dad and my stepmom had arranged to go over and meet her to do the Lares trek. So it's instead of the Inca Trail, it's this trek is a little more off the beaten track, if you like. Although it is a path, but you're going through sort of very remote places in terms of villages and stuff. It's not even villages, you'll go past the odd farm. So whereas the Inca Trail has something like 500 people on it a day, we saw no people whatsoever other than our group and the locals who might be on the track kind of taking food back and forth or whatever that they'd been working on.
Amazing.
Yeah,
that sounds like a real hidden gem then, to have like that alternative kind of experience there.
Oh, well, what's interesting is it was 12 years ago, so it might have changed a little bit, but absolutely. And I think we only went on that trek because the Inca Trail was fully booked. But it turned out that it was just us and our Sherpas and our guides. And yeah, it was just us. So you're not having to negotiate, you know, the other people around you or other groups. Yeah, so and then just that space. And I think that's why I love the treks that I do now. So I do treks now with Copperfeel. So this year we've been to Cornwall and to Scotland. We've been to the Himalayas. We've been to Oman. And it is just that feeling of when you're outside and you are trekking. So all you can focus on really is putting one foot in front of the other and where you are. There's just something so freeing in that, you know, thoughts come and go. You are able to process things that maybe you can't in an everyday world because we're constantly on the go. We've constantly got to go from A to B, or we've got a to-do list that's so long that you have to, you know, start crossing things off and it's never finished. So there is something amazing about being on trips like that that just cut you off. Mm. You know, we didn't have signal for most of it. And even that, it's disconnecting, isn't it? It's going offline for a bit.
And I imagine a really intimate way of connecting with your family as well because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's not all plain sailing. You know, you'd have the odd squabble and over silly stuff, or you'd be tired and people would take forever to get their ponchos out of their bag, and or then they'd go start walking, then they'd realize they need a snack, so they need to take everything off so they can get the snack out. And oh no, now the shoes are undone. Oh, actually, I might take the bottom of my trousers down and turn them into shorts. Like all these things, you're just kind of like, let's go. So it is still, I guess, a little bit frustrating in that sense, but you achieve something as a team, you know. And that is something that Peru taught me absolutely, is that when you're on treks like that, you can be the fastest person if you want, but the trek's not over until everyone's finished. So work as a team, be together, because the reward from that is just far greater. So yeah, so for me, Peru is a magical place in that sense of what it gave us. And it just, I guess ultimately, it just gave us space to be, which was... yeah, highly rewarding.
And so then you re-entered the world of Peru in your amazing new book, Walking on Sunshine. Yeah. So what made you decide to return there? And was it nice to re-enter that country and
absolutely
and transport yourself there, when I imagine you probably weren't able to travel at all? Was it during?
No. Yeah. And it's really interesting actually writing a book during a pandemic, because because on the one hand, you're like, do I reference that for these characters, or do I keep it as what everyone needs when they go to books, and it's escapism? You know, there are books that are going to have COVID as on this time as part of their story. Do I want to be that, especially when things are forever changing? Yeah. So if you were to put it in fiction, it would be out of date straight away. So I decided that they were still traveling and everything was, you know, as it was once was. And I almost changed location at some point as well. But for me, Peru, there was something about the fact that it was somewhere that they could go where it was just them and their guides as well. So basically the first couple of days, they are with the people who are going to be doing the Inca Trail. So there is that bigger group dynamic. I wanted it to go back down to these three friends, because ultimately they have all come to a part in life where they're kind of going, is this it? You know, someone's just got engaged, which should be amazing because she's seen everyone around her have that sort of, that chronological order that we all think we have to be in, where you get you meet someone, you move in together, you get married, you have children, and she's just got engaged, and she thought that's what she's always wanted, but suddenly those sort of nerves creep in, that doubt, that kind of actually, I'm never going to go on a first date again. I'm never going to have that first spark with anyone else. This is it forever. The realization of that, you know, is this it? Then you've got the mum who's kind of on that sort of hamster wheel of everything's always chaotic. Everything's always on her mother load. You know, she doesn't recognize herself compared to the woman that she once was. So again, she's sort of going, is this it? Is this my life forever? And then you've got Mike, who was married to Pia, who sadly just passed away. And he has had the love of his life and lost her, you know, and she's no longer with him. So he's consumed with his grief and this emptiness and loneliness and this guilt and anger. And again, he's kind of thinking, is this it? And they're all going through these different things, but not really communicating it. Mike, obviously, because they all knew Pia, they were all best mates. I guess Mike's journey is probably the most obvious between them, that they all recognize the fact that he's going through something, whereas the women probably is a little bit less discovered until they get to Peru. But yeah, so ultimately this trip is all about them stepping out of their comfort zones so that they can process the different things that they are going through in life.
And it's kind of representative, isn't it, of how travel experiences can be life-changing.
Yes, absolutely. Which is funny. I think it's that thing that we just simply get stuck in a rut, and we have to step outside of it sometimes to be able to evaluate and to realize that maybe things have to change. I don't think any of us, well, I think the majority of us will come home from a trip, especially if it's a more active trip where you're seeing parts of a country or culture and we adapt in certain ways. Whether that's, you know, every time I go to Italy, the pace is just so much slower. Mm-hmm. You've got people just enjoying, you know, a cup of coffee together in the afternoon. It's very sociable. People are standing and chatting to each other. And every time I come back, you're kind of like, that is what life's about. Like these people who 40 years ago had their homes completely knocked down. They've had their village rebuilt around them at such a slow pace. But they know what life, that they know what's important, and it's that bond, it's looking after each other, it's nurturing. So I, you know, that is probably the biggest lesson I've ever taken away from Italy for sure. But I think when you go to those places, that is what makes it life-changing. So I imagine if you go on a beach holiday and you're listening to loads of podcasts and or reading books, it can have the same effect, because you are stopping, you're enabling yourself to soak up all these other things that maybe you don't have time for in everyday life.
Yeah, very true. And giving yourself another way of having mental space, headspace.
Exactly, which we just simply don't have time for if you're just doing all the things that you do at home. But yeah, I do think that time away is, and what I think we've all realized in the last year and a half, that it doesn't need to be getting on a plane.
No.
You know, you can do that by staying in the UK as well.
Yeah. So I was at 3 Mile Beach in Cornwall and I heard that you were there.
This is my hidden gem. This is my hidden gem.
We'll come on to 3 Mile Beach in a moment then. First of all, we'll do chapter 4, which is your all-time favourite destination.
Oh, all-time favourite destination has to be Walt Disney World.
In Florida.
And I was taught in Florida. Yes, absolutely. And I was torn between there and Antigua, to be fair. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to go with Walt Disney World just because as a family now, as well, I think it was always magical before. And also for Tom's family. So Tom's family used to save up for around 2 years and they'd go on their trip to Disney, to Florida. They used to stay on international drive, so not in a Disney hotel. They used to save up and only be able to go there for one day, and they'd have to cram everything in. And now when we go, you know, we're able to stay in a Disney hotel and be in like park hopping for 2 weeks. And it is just, so I think it's always an emotional thing because we know how much it means to the Fletchers, like to all of them. We know how much being there used to mean, and it still means. So I guess that's why I say it's not just a theme park. It's more for us. It holds so many memories as well. Like we went there on our honeymoon.
Did you?
Yeah. Wow. So we went to St. Lucia. We went to Jade Mountain in St. Lucia, which is amazing. Like it's just idyllic. You know, you've got no fourth wall in your bedroom, which makes it sound quite theatrical and stagey, but there's no fourth wall. You've got a water, like an infinity pool. So every morning we were woken up like with the sunrise and diving into the pool. That's what we did first thing. And then went down to breakfast. Like, it was absolutely gorgeous. And then, so that was the first, I think we were on a 3-week honeymoon. So that was the first 10 days. We literally did nothing but read books and chill out. And then the second half of it was Disney World, and it was absolutely chaotic and wonderful. So we went there on our honeymoon. Then we were surprising Tom's parents. So they were going over there just as them two again. So the kids were grown up, but they were like, we're going to go over and just soak it up. And me and Tom ended up surprising them for 4 days. But the day before we flew out, the morning of the day we flew out, I took a pregnancy test just in case, so I know before getting on the flight, and I found out I was pregnant. So walking around Disney, you know, knowing that, you know, I'm growing a life. So that made it really magical. And then subsequently going back with our children. So it just holds so many great memories and, you know, happy feelings, which so actually I have actually just made a podcast with Walt Disney Travel Company,
my big competitor now in the travel category. Yes.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. The season is complete now.
It's fine. You'll be back up there. It's fine. But just seeing how what that place means to people, you know, Davina McCall in her episode, she cried before we even started recording. Then I literally had to say one thing about the place and she was bawling her eyes out, because it means, you know, there is this innocence that comes with it that is just magical.
Yeah, I completely agree. And kind of thinking about childhood, I mean, and having children, happy mum, happy baby, podcast phenomenon. Nearly 16 million downloads with three young ones. You know, have you found a winning formula for travel? Like, or is it just being tired somewhere else, as some people say?
I was really, when I first heard that about the same, different locations, same rubbish or same, you know, stuff. I think it was a swear word. I won't use it. I was a bit like, oh no, that's sad, isn't it? But actually it's not that at all. Obviously the flight. So my first experience of getting on a plane was with Buzz when he was 10 months old. This was my second experience, but this was the biggest one, I guess, because I flew him to Australia on my own because Tom was touring with McBusted and they were supporting One Direction. So they were over in Australia.
That's a hell of a long flight with a baby.
Yes, exactly.
That's brave.
And in my head, I had all these ideas of, you know, what it was going to be like. And he just cried. So if I tried to put him down into the cot, so I keep trying to do it. And then at one point, I just thought, what are you doing? Just hold him. If he wants to be held because it's in this strange place, do it. And I just got into this little routine with him where, you know, he'd sleep, then he'd get up, I'd give him some food, then we'd have a little play, then I'd give him a boob feed, and then he'd fall asleep. And we'd just go on that cycle. Because also, I think one thing about planes is that when you get to the other end, the time is different anyway. So when you get there, you have to work out what you're doing time zone wise anyway. So for me, when it comes to flights, it is just going with the flow. Also, I felt like on that Australia flight when he was crying, I thought, oh my God, everyone hates me. And I cried. And then actually when we had to change over in Dubai, three different people came over to me and said, you're doing really well.
That means so much, I imagine.
It really does. Yeah. It really does. Because all of a sudden you realize that people aren't against you. And I'm not sure, some people were a bit annoyed that there was a baby on the plane, but ultimately I was trying my best, because you don't want your baby to cry either. Like, you want them to be settled, because it's simply not nice to feel like they're you know, screaming their head off and stuff. So yeah, so it was, well, I think that also just kind of made me go, yeah, just take a breath. And I can remember before getting on that flight, I had been watching This Morning, and a woman was on there debating whether children should even be allowed on flights. And I just thought, oh my God, the world is made up of people like that who think my children just should stay in the UK all the time. You know, so I thought the plane was made up of people like that. And actually, it wasn't. No. It was all fine. No.
And, you know, I have to quickly ask you, I remember so vividly listening to your episode with Kate Middleton, Duchess of Cambridge. Yes. I was actually on my honeymoon when I listened to it. I was lying on a balcony in the sun and I was like, holy shit, what an incredible guest. That is like the biggest get I've ever seen. I was like looking at the podcast app. Oh my God. So how did it come about and how did it feel? Was it your most intimidating interview that you've ever done?
Yes, absolutely it was. So essentially, she does a lot of work in early years and she had this big five big questions that she wanted to launch where they were asking everyone. So it wasn't just parents, it was carers, it was people within the community, everyone to take part in this survey so that they could get a real rounded view of what people felt was important in early years. And early years is just is an incredibly important stage of a child's development because essentially 0 to 5, so many things get fixed in place. So it is a really important part of development to focus on. So she wanted to get the survey out there. And we were looking at ways that we could use Have Mum, Have Baby to really launch that, to help them, to support it. Because ultimately it's all about if you have to help the parents to help the child. You know, it's a thing where everyone needs to support everyone. And so we were talking about it with her team and she wasn't there at this point. And I was a bit like, well, you know, is there any chance that we can get Kate to be involved or Catherine or the Duchess? The Duchess is only what I would reference her as. And and we were like, oh, we don't know. They said, you know, she doesn't usually do things like that. So it's a bit outside of her comfort zone. And I was like, okay. And then they invited me along to the launch of the event. And I knew that I was going to get five minute private time with her. So she came over and we just had this. So we were in, what was it called? Like a soft play center. And we were talking about what it would be like if our children were there. And I was talking about the fact that my children are quite feral. So, you know, God knows what they'd be doing. And then we were just talking about maternal mental health and everything like that. And then it was a really surreal situation to be in because we were literally left alone. And literally off the back of that and a big group chat with other people that had been part of the survey, I then got told that I'd get 45 minutes with her. And I was like, okay, we can do this. Amazing. But because it was about the survey as well, we were going to have experts within it. And actually, I wasn't asked for a breakdown of what I was going to be asking her about until the night before. So I just thought, well, because I could hold back, but I just thought this is the one time to actually have this conversation. So I just literally sent in a list, if it was any other podcast, what I would like to talk about. And her comms team came back and were like, oh, we're not sure if she'll talk about this or this or this or this, but let us take this to her and see what happens. And then I heard that Prince William was in the room when she was being briefed. And he said, just answer the question, like, just talk. Because if you don't want it in there, we can just edit out afterwards, but just talk. And it was the most amazing experience ever. You know, we were in the room for an hour and a half. It was absolutely amazing. Because also she's a mom. Yeah. She's just a woman. And what was interesting is that after it, she spoke so amazingly about the work. The answer was, I was like, we don't need the experts because actually what you're doing by putting those in is you're undermining her. You're kind of saying, well, she doesn't know what she's talking about. So let's put these experts in where she clearly does. And she's so passionate about it. So, so we didn't have those experts in the end. It was all her.
And you were like on Good Morning America and it just went absolutely crazy. Was it like the most whirlwind week ever? I mean, did the podcast go mad as well?
The podcast went mad. The reception to it was absolutely bonkers because at that point, no one had heard her speak in that way.
It really humanized her and made her so much more relatable. And you did such a good job of really, you know, making her obviously feel so comfortable.
It's really interesting how much she's done since then. And I watch on like a proud mum, kind of going, yes, because, you know, it must be such a big thing to step out and to have that sort of personal element of yourself.
And scrutiny for anything that you say. Everything is a soundbite.
Every single thing. So, yeah, I felt hugely privileged that she would have that chat, that she would trust the platform, because we all know how great podcasts can be. And I think the thing with podcasts that you don't necessarily get outside of them is that you get the freedom to talk. You know, you don't have to make everything a soundbite. You know, you can explain, you can you can expand on topics so that things aren't taken out of context.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. They're more of a safe space in that way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb super host. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So moving on then, I think I might know the answer to this one. Chapter 5, Your Hidden Gem, a place that you love that maybe my listeners don't know so much about.
Well, I absolutely love Cornwall, which everyone will know about. But I have to say, we have absolutely loved Cornwall before the pandemic when everyone kind of
discovered it.
Down there. Yeah, exactly. And we do stay mostly at Watergate Bay because, it's just gorgeous. But this summer, we stayed at a new location called 3 Mile Beach, which is simply amazing. It's very Scandi in its design, and there's just a nice little walk down to the beach. But it's essentially it's your own little house as well, which I love. I feel like when you've got kids as well, it takes the stress off a little bit, knowing that firstly you're separated from everyone else, so that if they make noise, it's fine. You know, there's not a wall adjoining us to somewhere else, but also so they could have their bedrooms and we can be sitting in the lounge or still having, going in the kitchen. Because so many times, I mean, we've done the holidays where it's all bedrooms and, you know, when they go to sleep, or it's one bedroom, and when everyone goes to sleep, you just sit there and you can't make a peep because otherwise they're going to wake up. Whereas a place like 3 Mile Beach, you know, you've got the freedom, and actually it's so gorgeous. There's a little tuk-tuk outside of an evening where you can go and get your sort of cocktail mixers and stuff and all your cocktails. And
such a good idea.
So good.
So I was there the week after you were there.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And everyone was like, oh, the Fletchers were just here. They were so nice.
Well, everyone we met was so lovely and welcoming, and, everyone smiled. It's literally like you couldn't do enough. And even like simple little things, like we were looking through the brochure once we were there, and we saw that they even do like little touches, like there are guitars available if you want a guitar. And we all know that when you're on a beach holiday, well, not people that don't know, don't play instruments, but when you're on a beach holiday and things like that, it's quite nice to have a guitar and, you know, be able to strum, because it's quite an inspirational place to be, because you've got the sea, it's nature, isn't
totally.
It? Nature is it fuels the creativity. So I can remember on that first day just calling down and being like, to ask, but is it possible? And they were like, yeah, absolutely. And it's just every little thing that we asked for, they delivered on, and they were just simply amazing.
And not forgetting Gwythian Beach as well, because I feel like I travel quite a lot around Cornwall as well, and obviously you know it really well, but I hadn't been to that beach before, and I was absolutely gobsmacked. It is such a stunning part of Cornwall, isn't it? It's so vast. It's so dramatic. Yeah. You can see St. Ives in the distance. Uh-huh. And the bright green of the grass with the turquoise of the water on a sunny day in particular, it really just felt like somewhere I couldn't imagine would have been in the UK.
Exactly. And months before, so I had booked that earlier on in the year, and then our trip, so our Copperfield trek had changed from the Sahara, obviously, because we can't get there, to Cornwall. And literally weeks before we were staying at 3 Mile Beach, I was literally walking that part of the coastal towards St. Ives. Yeah, yeah. So there's the Jam Pot, the little cafe that we literally walked in. Some of our group went in to get coffees and teas and stuff. So I walked literally right past the front of 3 Mile.
Amazing.
And had no idea that it was actually there until we got there later on. But it's for me, that is a real hidden gem. And even beach-wise, it's quite quiet. Because in the morning when you get there, the water is so far in, and and then when it goes out, it's just vast. It's
and golden.
There's so much, and yes, so golden. Yes, yeah. Proper sand to dig.
Glorious, so good for kids. I imagine it's such a great place, and so like well stocked as well with everything you might need, like you say.
Exactly, and the thing again about 3 Mile, they have these little like trolley type things that we've never had before. So when we stay at like Watergate Bay, we put all of our boards under our arms, and we're trying to like donkeys trying to travel down there. But they have these trolleys outside the houses that you literally bung all your stuff in, and a kid if you need to, if they're whining and they don't want to do the walk. And you just, you wheel it down to the beach. It's amazing. It makes life so much easier.
Perfect staycation spot. But very much in contrast to that, chapter 6 is your worst travel experience.
Well, I was a kid. I think we were about 9, and it was our first summer doing something that wasn't Italy. And we went to Tenerife. Which is a lovely place to go. I have to say that it is absolutely lovely. But our experience, so I can remember it was in the days we used to go down to the travel agents and get all the brochures. So we only had a few pictures of what this place is going to be like. There was a big octopus and this water thing, and it was absolutely beautiful. And then we got there, all we could see is the motorway, which, we're like, okay. And I can just remember mum and dad then having to go down to the travel agents to sort it out. Oh, but on the first day, everything was going wrong. And we had to get food in, and simple things like they'd got us eggs. None of us ate eggs, but they made hard-boiled eggs for us, and they made us eat them, even though we really didn't want to eat. Like, just simple things that just add up. And then the next morning, we went to the travel agents to sort everything out and see if there was an alternative to where we were. And we got there, and no one came for hours. And but they weren't late. We just hadn't changed the clocks on our time. We hadn't noticed we'd forgotten the time difference. I can just remember the tension building of, this is the worst holiday in existence because I'm not in the pool right now. And that is exactly where I should be. Actually, I've got to say, after that, it was a really good trip. We met some great people. The hotel that we went to was amazing. I got sunburned on the first day. it's like that typical kid thing where you just want to be in the pool all the time. Yeah. So then you have to wear the t-shirt of shame afterwards. But that was, a pretty... I think because holidays are meant to be stress-free in so many ways, but they do bring stress. They absolutely do. And I think for us, that was a stressful start to it.
Probably as a parent now, you can look back on it and be like, oh, my poor parents, they must have been so stressed out. Well, it has been so wonderful chatting to you, G. And we are now on to chapter 7, the final chapter of your travel diaries, which is the destination at the top of your travel bucket list.
So I have to go for a trekking location, simply because that for me, those are the places that I go and I see the world in a very different way. So, and actually there are three on my bucket list. I'd love to go to Kili because I feel like lots of trekkers go to Kilimanjaro and it is the most amazing thing. I just think there is something about that. But also the flip side of that is actually I don't need to go where everyone else goes, but at some point I would like to experience it. Mm-hmm. I'd also love to go to Madagascar because there are some great treks that happen there. Apparently, you know, the animals and things that you see are meant to be amazing.
The lemurs.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that.
You should listen to Simon Reeves' episode of this podcast because he picks it as his all-time favorite destination and he like sort of sells it so well. It made me want to go so much.
Really? Yeah. Oh, the thing about a trek like that is it's just a bit longer. So you're asking if I was to do it with, as a Copperfield trek, which is basically how I'm seeing the world now, where do I want to go? Let's put that as the destination.
We should just quickly say who Copperfield are.
Copperfield are a breast cancer awareness charity aimed... everyone, but also to change the narrative around breast cancer from a much younger age. The founder, Chris, was diagnosed with stage 4 secondary breast cancer at the age of 23. And it's making people aware of the signs and symptoms. You know, they're not just a lump, which we would have known growing up. It's dimpling, it's puckering, it's thickening of the breast tissue, it's inverted nipple, it's nipple discharge. Any changes that you notice on your chest, on your breast, and it's, you know, it's up to your collarbone and under your armpit. Any changes that you know, you have to go and get it checked out because the earlier someone is diagnosed with breast cancer, the higher their chances of survival. So although it might sound scary, actually, it's just their main message is to get to know your body and do something about it if it changes. So it's not to scare people. It's literally just to say, you know, just know what your normal is.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, everything will be fine, hopefully, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you want to go to Madagascar, hopefully, on a trek.
Yes.
And where was the final one?
The final one is the Appalachian Trail in America, because I've just read Unlost by Gail Miller.
Yes.
And, you know, it's just like miles and miles and miles and miles and miles of different terrain, different landscape, and the way... You know, if we all talk about these treks and stuff and traveling as finding yourself, then this is miles and miles and miles to do that, like hundreds of miles of trekking. Could even be thousands, but I've definitely hundreds.
Sounds beautiful. I've seen photos of the Appalachian Trail, and it's I think it's a bit of a also like quite undiscovered for British travellers.
Yes. And also because every state you get to, there's a different terrain.
Yeah.
So, you know, and different parts of it. The people that Gail met along the way, and everyone has a reason for being there. And I mean, it's definitely one of those ones that as a mum, I can't just skip out for months to do the Appalachian Trail, but it is definitely one that is on my bucket list, and I have to be young enough to be able to actually physically do it. But at some point, even if I was to do it in chunks, I feel like that is that's certainly bucket list kind of, I'd love to experience it. Because also just everything around it just sounds, you know, you're completely cut off, you know, you aren't, life just isn't, you know, isn't there in the same way. And for me, that is definitely one that I would love to do.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. It's been absolutely lovely to chat to you, Giovanna Fletcher. Those were your travel diaries. What a pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh, big thank you to Giovanna. It was so lovely to hear her travel diaries and to speak to someone whose voice is so familiar as a fellow podcaster. Really enjoyed that. Giovanna's new novel, Walking on Sunshine, is out now. Thanks so much for listening today. If you are enjoying the podcast, then don't forget to hit subscribe, or if you use Apple Podcasts, to hit follow so that a new episode lands in your podcast app each week. And if you really enjoyed it, then if you fancy leaving a rating or a review, that would be extra special. If you want to find out who's joining me on next week's episode, come and follow me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. Would love to hear from you, as always. And if you can't wait till then, remember there's all of the first 5 seasons to catch up on. Nearly 70 episodes to keep you busy there. And don't forget that all the destinations mentioned by my guests I always include in the episode show notes. And they're also always on my website, thetraveldiariespodcast.com. And here's another podcast you can escape into. Life Sentence, a Mags Creative Original, is an immersive audio journey and a powerful story of the climate crisis, with Jordan Stevens leading an incredible cast lending their voices to it. Time is ticking on this one, and you have to hear it to believe it.